VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. Now, with me in the studio today, I am delighted to welcome back Stuart Robson. And with him also is the one and only living Gearbrandt in captivity. It's Mr. James. Later on, we're going to be joined by a former regular on this podcast, Paddy Barclay. We'll be talking to him about his new book on the legendary Sir Matt Busby. And perhaps also talking a little bit of David Moyes with him. I'm just going on the fact that they're both Scots, right? So they all know each other, right? They've all shared intimate moments, probably on the golf course, in fact. But first, we need to start with the Three Lions. Stuart, international friendly, prestige opponent. Southgate calls up a bunch of kids, and then he called up more kids for the Brazil friendly on Tuesday. Makes sense, right?
Yes, it makes sense because a lot of the senior players dropped out, of course. It makes sense because he's been promoting a lot of these young players when he was the under-21 manager. He said what great players they were. They won the Toulon tournament last year with him in charge.
The Toulon tournament is not a real thing. Okay,
but so England have won the under-20. They've won the under-17.
Talk about,
they've done those things. They've done very well over the last couple of years. And I think he's trying to say something to the Premier League managers that if you give some of these players a chance, they're good enough, you know, and you won't know whether they're good enough until you do give them a chance. And the likes of Loftus-Cheek, who, when I saw him at Chelsea, never got that many opportunities, but I'm not sure he did himself that many favours when he did play. He's gone to Crystal Palace, but he's been along the England route at under-17, under-19, under-21 level. Gareth Southgate knows him well, and he thinks he's good enough to come in and play. And he had a good game against Germany.
When people talk about, well, you know, no, Chelsea are bad when they send people on loan, but then they're also bad guys when they keep people there because, you know, he did spend 3 years at the club and, right, Mourinho's second season, they were terrible, but, you know, he won 2 Premier League titles in those 3 years and he didn't get many games, but a lot of it is because he was, what, 18, 19, and 20 in those years. What's been put to me by people at Chelsea when they saw him coming through is a lot of guys actually compared him to, they compared him to Michael Ballack in some ways because he isn't an attacking midfielder, but he's got a certain skill set. Because of his size, people played him deeper. I know Southgate played him deeper with the under-21s occasionally. And the fact is, on those teams, with the way Chelsea were set up, he wasn't going to break in ahead of Hazard and Willian and people like that.
If you're a young player coming into a team like Manchester City, Chelsea, you can't just have a good game, because there's already really top-class players there. So when you come in, you get one chance, maybe two chances. You've got to be the best player on the field. Otherwise, you go back down and they say, well, you know, he's not going to affect the game as much as Hazard is. He's not going to affect the game as much as Willian is. He's not going to affect the game as much as Pedro is. So it's very difficult for him to actually make a real case for getting into the side on a regular basis. So he's probably at the right place at the moment, playing for Crystal Palace. And if he has a great season for Crystal Palace, then he becomes a player that people want to buy, you know, off Chelsea for and play in a top side. But I think he has to prove himself playing at a slightly lower level side, like Crystal Palace, like a West Ham or Southampton. And that's when you get your reputation. That's when people will come and come. It's happened to likes of Matic, that he couldn't get in at Chelsea, goes somewhere else, then plays brilliantly, and they go and buy him back.
Gearbrandt, would you see him in starting for any top 16?
Well, I think that there are ways of doing it, aren't there? I mean, I think we might have said the same about Harry Winks last season. We might have said, okay, well, he's had one or two decent performances, but could you really see him starting? And actually, this season, he is starting for Tottenham. The problem at Chelsea, obviously, is that...
Well, he's starting now that certain players are injured. Mm. I mean, it took that for him to get...
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, he's maybe not, you know, in your absolute...
We'll see what happens if Dembele's ever fully fit and when Wanyama comes back.
But the point is that Mauricio Pochettino has had him in his plans and he's given him the opportunity. Whereas at Chelsea, Loftus-Cheek has been sent on loan and they signed Timore Bakayoko, who plays sort of, could argue, because obviously Loftus-Cheek is quite a versatile player, but he plays sort of more or less in the same position as Loftus-Cheek. If you send a young player out on loan, if he's not quite ready for the first team, like a Loftus-Cheek, if you send him out on loan to a sort of a slightly inferior club, a lower table club, in theory, you know, he should shine there. I actually think Loftus-Cheek has played pretty well at Crystal Palace so far because, you know, it's a slightly kind of lesser club and in theory his quality should stand out. But actually, I think the example of Harry Wink shows, and also you could argue Loftus-Cheek against Germany, is that some players, given a bit of responsibility and the occasion, will rise to the occasion, whereas you might be sent on loan to a struggling team and you can sort of be dragged down by the dysfunction there.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of... Most of the young players that get into sides in the top six get there with that little bit of luck. They're good players, but somebody gets injured, somebody gets suspended for quite a while. And I'll use Kieran Gibbs as an example, who played for England, who nobody thought was ever going to get into Arsenal's team. There was no thought about him getting into the Arsenal team. Then they had a problem... at left back. Goal Clichy gets transferred. They didn't have anybody else to put in there. The player that they put in there, they bought from Brazil, had an absolute shocker.
Andre Santos.
And Kieran Gibbs gets an opportunity because there's two or three injuries. And he plays well for 3 or 4 weeks. They decide to keep him in the side and he plays well for maybe a year. And he gets an England call-up. And suddenly he's considered a Premier League player. So you need that little bit of luck to get your chance. Although, and then you've got to take your chance.
Although then you could also argue then he spends another, 6 years at the club and contributes absolutely nothing because he's not an Arsenal caliber player. I don't know what Loftus-Cheek's future is going to be. But he's playing on a team with Conte, who I presume is a much greater player than Loftus-Cheek might ever become. Eden Hazard as well. You can debate Willian and what. Do you know what I mean? Like,
your body language. You know, so we're talking about on the ball. He's technically very good. I want to see a bit more dynamism from him, and he has got that because everybody tells me he's very quick. He's very powerful. He's very good technically, but I think he wants to play at his own pace. Slightly, you know, all the great players, if we're talking about going on to be great players, they could play slowly and then they could at the switch of a button they could flick it on and be super fast, you know. And I'm talking about the best, the Cruyffs, the George Bests, all these sort of players. They had the technical ability to do things slowly and be controlled on the ball, but when they needed to burst away from people, they burst away from. And I'm not sure I see that with Loftus-Cheek, and I don't think it's because he can't do it. I think he wants to play a little bit at his own pace.
Are you going to stick up for Loftus-Cheek since you're closer to him in age than Stuart?
I just wonder if players sometimes get damned on a sort of character basis because of the type of player that they are. I mean, you very rarely sort of hear defensive midfielders being criticised for a lack of hunger, whereas Loftus-Cheek, he's not an outright defensive midfielder. He's sort of a kind of rangy, skillful.
He's Michael Ballack.
He's more that type
late
of player.
Model Michael Ballack.
And he's a very skillful player. And I wonder if that sometimes comes across. I don't know. Maybe to.
But to be Michael Ballack, he's got to go and score more goals. He's got to be driving into the box to win headers. He's got to make sure that he's running games. Mm. That's what Michael Ballack did when he was at his best.
Michael Ballack. He can be Kevin Nolan.
Yeah, true.
I think of Tammy Abraham. The point was made to be by people at Chelsea, actually, that. You know, he had this tremendous year at Bristol City where he scored a lot of goals on a fairly, I don't follow the championship, but I can read a table, on a fairly mediocre championship side where, you know, they didn't necessarily have a lot of the ball and he had a lot of space and he was the main attacking terminus and so on. And the point was made that, you know, at Chelsea it would be different because Chelsea would have most of the ball against, you know, you go and you play Burnley and they have 8 people back and there's a different skill set involved in that. And so maybe a year at Swansea, where again, this would be a side where, you know, wouldn't be very good and he would be the main threat, might be better for him than having him come off the bench the way Michy Batshuayi does, when usually when Chelsea desperately need a goal and there's a million players around him. I was just thinking about that. And then Tammy Abraham plays for England, and England are a team who like to keep the ball and like to try to, we can debate whether it's the right thing to do or not, but it is a different experience. I mean, you've been there as a player and you've coached these guys. How much does the way a team actually plays impact the situation, especially for a young player?
Yeah, of course it does. You know, when you're Antonio Conte, when he's managing a team, I think the major strength of the centre forward has to be that he can play with his back to goal to link up the play and then break forward. You couldn't play Tammy Abraham in that position because he
not yet. He hasn't
not yet because he wouldn't develop. He's not so good with his back to goal. He's somebody that wants to run forward. If you're playing counter-attacking football,
but he certainly has the body for it, right?
Yeah,
because he's a big guy and he's aggressive.
But there's having the body and there's also having the technical ability to play with your back to goal.
I want to talk a little bit about Brazil because, just to plug something else that's in the game, James, you wrote a very long piece, research piece, about Brazil's revival. For me right now, under Chicha, they probably are the best team in the world. They have a bit of a complex because they haven't played any Western European sides in the time frame. I think it's entirely irrelevant. Just take me through how they managed to sort of break the whole sort of Dunga, Scolari, Stasis, 7-1 hangover to put together what they have today.
So after the 7-1 defeat in semifinals of the 2014 World Cup, I think a lot of Brazilians, from what I understand, assumed that Tite would be the next manager. He was sort of seen as the obvious appointment because he'd had a lot of success with Corinthians.
Sorry, you have to pronounce it the way Brazilians
Tite.
Pronounce it. Sorry. Apologies to all my Brazilian friends.
But instead, the Brazilian Football Confederation went back to Dunga, who obviously had already had an unsuccessful stint in charge of the national team. Dunga then oversaw two poor Copa America campaigns, one where they lost in the quarterfinal and one where they didn't even make it out of the group. They then began South American qualifying for the 2018 World Cup. They had, I think, 9 points from 6 games, so they were sixth after 6 games. Dunga was then fired. Tite was then appointed by the Brazilian Football Confederation, and he clearly has completely turned things around to the extent that in the remaining 12 games under Tite, I think they took 32 points, which on their own would have been enough to top South American qualifying compared to the 18 games that everyone else had played.
So how did he change it?
He went to look into China, which, you know, it's funny because we in Europe are like, oh, China, they've all packed it in, right? But he goes to China and he gets Paulinho and Renato Augusto, who, you know, really have been stellar, I think. But really the only other newcomer is Gabriel Jesus, right, who perhaps Dunga and Scolari did not have. So it's the same cast of characters, and maybe the goalkeeper with Alisson. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of the actual team that played the 7-1, it is quite different, or at least it appears quite different, because of those players, I think it's only really Marcelo and Fernandinho that are still involved. So the likes of David Luiz, for example, has still not made his way back into the squad. But if you look at the wider 2014 World Cup squad, well, he didn't
play in that game.
Yeah, he certainly didn't start it.
I mean, but they were on the squad.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say. Neymar, Thiago Silva, Paulinho is in the squad as well. Willian, I think, was in the squad. One thing that has helped Neymar, as I understand it, is that Coutinho is now, he's very much in the first choice starting 11. And Neymar and Coutinho played together in the Brazil under-17 and under-20 teams. And I think that helps Neymar to have Coutinho, who he knows very well, to link up with.
I was watching Sunday Supplement. It hadn't occurred to me. But they made the point that there's been no pullouts from the Brazil squad. Why'd you compare that to England? And it's like, oh, groan. And, you know, you've got like 12 people pulling out. Now, I know there's different reasons in different contexts, but I think it's remarkable that everybody wants to be a part of this excitement that Chicha's generated. West Ham, who of course won the World Cup in 1966 and were once captained, I believe, by a Stuart Robson with hair. Is that right?
With hair, yeah.
Yes. They have a new manager. It's David Moyes. And joining us is Paddy Barkley, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's been a while.
I know.
You a while.
I was wondering where you've been hiding.
Not long enough.
But I want to discuss this because David Moyes is one of those people who I like as a person, yes, as well as admiring some of his work as a manager. Some of it's been good, some of it less good. What I struggle with, and what I think a lot of people struggle with, including our colleague Matt Dickinson, who wrote a whole column about this, is why he's taking a job at West Ham and Dicko has serious concerns about a genuinely good person, like David Moyes, getting involved with the unholy trinity. Is that unfair?
No, it's reasonable. I personally would disagree in the sense that David Moyes has to... What if he'd said no? Every other employer would say, he doesn't fancy it. What does he think? What, does he want a top four club again? I think he had to have a go at it. He's probably also looked at the squad and thought, I can get to fourth bottom with this lot, in which case I'm a hero. Like, you know, various, managers of Sunderland became heroes because of saving Sunderland. And he's obviously reckons the chances are 60-40 on, and therefore he's taken it. I feel that he is a good manager. I mean, it's not a question.
Do you think he still believes he's a good manager? Because the last couple of jobs he's had, when I've seen him interviewed, he doesn't look the same person that I knew when he was at Preston.
Yeah.
And the same person that I knew when he was at Everton.
Look, he wouldn't be human if he wasn't shaken by his experiences at Manchester United, Sunderland, and in Spain as well. Mm. But... at the same time, he either gives up and goes and lives on a country estate in, you know, Lancashire or somewhere, or he reproves himself. He has to do it. I'm absolutely certain those will have been his thought process. Of course, he's not stupid. Sir Alex Ferguson doubted himself during the first 5 years at Manchester United, and David will have doubted himself, even though there are excuses in each case. I mean, Sunderland, for heaven's sake... Who's going to be a successful manager there? Manchester United immediately after Ferguson, with all the problems you get from the players, and he got more than he should have done from the players. Real Sociedad, wasn't it? One of the clubs that, you know, seem perpetually now in Spain, to be unable to compete at even the second level, let alone the first. So I think, there are excuses. He knows the truth, that he didn't really fail with potential, but... At West Ham, he does have a job with some potential.
He's going to have to change the philosophy at West Ham.
The off-field philosophy. He's going to have to change the dressing room for a start, which is a disgrace, quite frankly. And the off-the-field, I think, will be easier because although the Three Musketeers, or whatever you would call Brady Sullivan...
Unholy Trinity,
thank you. Whatever you would call them, they haven't distinguished themselves over Bilic, or indeed since moving to the Olympic Stadium. But by and large, during their careers in football, they have not been notorious sackers in the sense that other people weren't. So they just have to revert to type. And oddly enough, I feel that David Moyes is an ideal, and again, you know, it's not a question of me saying it, it's a question of his record. He's a very good long-term manager. And he's someone that I feel that Sunderland should have tried to... They weren't good enough for him, frankly, Sunderland as a club. You might say, yeah, West Ham, not great off the field. But my word, it's like a proper football club compared with Sunderland.
But they say that what's been going on under Bilic in recent times, it's been almost like a holiday camp, the players turning up when they want to.
With that in mind, though, I'm wondering, maybe this is too easy a reading. It was confirmed last night that, what a lot of people had reported, that Stuart Pearce is coming in as his assistant.
Yeah.
Now...
Along with Alan Irvin as well.
Okay, yeah. Nobody knows who Alan Irvin is, whereas everybody knows who Psycho is, and Stuart Pearce is a...
You know, that's his technique. You know, one he knows well, and one the club knows.
Okay,
well.
But here's my thing, right? Mm. So I don't see any real commonality between Stuart Pearce and David Moyes. And I'm guessing, you mentioned the word holiday camp. Mm. Is it something as simple as... You know, he's going to play, Stuart Pearce is there to play bad cop and Moisey's good cop. A little bit like your pal Walter Smith and Archie Knox come in to shout at people.
Yeah, no, I think, I don't think you can, I mean, Stuart will correct me if I'm wrong here, but I don't think you can have a really bad cop these days. I think that the power of the player is so great, his economic independence makes it very difficult for anybody to be a really bad cop.
Antonio Conte can be a really, really bad cop.
Yeah, and you know, probably last week or next week you'll be discussing the crisis at Chelsea. So it's very difficult to manage footballers these days, more difficult than it's ever been. And it's going to get worse.
Why appoint Stuart Pearce?
I'd imagine he thinks that Stuart Pearce will be a good motivator of the players and a good... And I've maybe been a bit of a jolly up man with the players. He'll be taking all the warm-ups. He'll be doing the little side drills while David Moyes and Alan Irvin, who is his other coach, who's probably a better coach than Stuart Pearce, will come out and take most of the technical work and the tactical work. And Stuart Pearce will be somebody that will try and G the players up, and he'll be on their side because he's a good character.
Yeah.
So everybody tells me.
Yeah.
And
he's a straight guy.
And he's a nice, honest chap.
Yeah.
That now managers have to surround themselves with a coaching team of four or five.
Yes, yes.
Because
exactly.
they feel too lonely when they're by themselves, and there's too many players that can go against them. And
they've got enough support.
Yeah.
James. So you're talking about all these old people, right?
Yeah, they're crowding you out.
You've probably never seen Stuart Pearce play.
Well,
you haven't, have you?
Not in the flesh, no.
No. A couple of things that occurred to me from what you were saying, Paddy.
Yeah, right.
One, do you think that the West Ham dressing room he's walking into is actually that different from the Sunderland dressing room? Because it strikes me that actually, in terms of the squad profile, it's quite similar in that you've got a quite sort of old... core of mostly British, well, not mostly British, but you've got an old core of British players,
let's name names here to help people along. You're talking about Mark Noble,
part of Lee Cattermole will be played by Mark Noble.
Yeah.
Okay. Premier League experience. Up front, you've got, you know, you're quite reliant on a sort of quite ageing poacher type striker.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't look at the Sunderland squad last year and think it was terrible. Mm. It just sort of didn't work. It would sort of wasn't quite.
Well, he was in his defence, he was named Sunderland manager way late.
Mm.
I think it was late July, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And on top of that, I think there were certain restrictions to what he could do with the squad because of the financial situation. And that's why he ended up taking all those rubbish United players on loan.
He couldn't get rid of some of the bad players because they were on too much money. Nobody else would take them. They're on contract. Yeah. And he couldn't get new players in because he didn't have enough money.
He could also have avoided taking people like Donald Love in, but, you know, it's a cool name, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But here, this is... Because it's become fashionable to go and blame, you know, Noble, he doesn't have the legs anymore, and Arnautovic, he's lazy. Fine. Mm. Take Noble and Arnautovic out of the mix. Mm. If the other people are fit, this squad is still a mid-table squad. The West Ham is really, really, really good
thing to
players.
Do, from what I've heard about West Ham, they're unfit because the training hasn't been disciplined enough. The players have... it's been like a holiday camp there. And it's very difficult mid-season for David Moyes to come in and get the players fit up and running at the pace he wants them. Because he's going to play, I'd imagine, quite a high-pressing game. He wants his players to be athletic. And I'm not sure the players are athletic at the moment. When I've seen them play...
They have international football. There's... I don't know. I just think if you have a good manager, quality makes a difference. And And these are really good players that he has.
I mean, the other thing that I was going to say is that, as you pointed out, Paddy, David Moyes is a very good long-term manager. Yeah. I mean, the key success on his record was that kind of, Everton, Everton, that big sort of almost dynastic success that he had there. And what he's ostensibly been asked to come in and do here is a sort of, you know, he's only on a contract at the end of the season, is a sort of short-term firefighting job, which I don't... Does that necessarily play to his strengths?
Well... I do agree with you there. I think your analysis is absolutely spot on. The only thing I would say was that when he first went to Everton from Preston, it was a relegation fight. It really was. David Unsworth, who was there, I remember him being in the team.
Unzi.
And was in the team, and it was a relegation fight, and he got them out of that, and he turned the team around. Now, if he believes and you and Robbo believe, and I'm pretty sure, and Gab probably is, that there is enough at West Ham to finish fourth bottom. And I would put it no higher than that.
Really?
Yes. Because basically, you don't win matches without character. And this is a squad without... It's got no communal character.
But that's why
you're the
manager.
They play the way they do.
I don't know, I still think it's down to the players, and I think
yes, they do.
These are really good players relative to the teams that are around them in the table. And I'll give you a better scenario. Mm. How about West Ham to finish mid-table, Unzi to get the job through the end of the season at Everton, mm-hmm. Everton avoid relegation, yeah. And Moyes returns home in the summer, so he doesn't have to soil himself with the unholy trinity anymore.
Oh, I think this is the next thing.
Would he go for that?
The next thing that would happen would be Moisey would wake up and go, "Oh, it was only a dream."
Now, Paddy, the reason we have you here is also to discuss your book. Because you wrote about a guy who is revered. He has a street named after him.
Yep.
But let's face it, I think he did a lot of his best work many years ago.
Yep.
I believe before, when you were a child even, that's how long it was.
Even before, he did some of his best. Yes, when I was a child, he did some of his best work while I was still a gleam in my daddy's eye.
There you go. Mm. So we are delving back into
history. We are going back a long time.
But we are talking about one of the real icons of football in the Scepter Dial, and that's Matt Busby. And I'm curious because obviously this has been covered. Matt Busby actually wrote an autobiography, and it's funny because there's I tweeted this out the other day. There's a wonderful interview with Busby on Parkinson, who for those who don't know is a former presenter in this country, where among other things he has a go at Clough. And he refers to the sport as soccer, and he actually his autobiography is actually called soccer.
Soccer, something or other. Yeah, yep, yep.
So much for those like, oh, it's football, not soccer. I mean, back then.
In the old days, nobody worried about that.
Matt Busby was okay calling it soccer, but
football
anyway.
Incorrectness hadn't been invented then.
I was struck, and the reason I recommend people take a look at this interview as they read the book, because it's also different when you see somebody sort of coming to life, not just as a screaming picture, but just... But what prompted you? Because a lot's been written about him. A lot's been said about him. Mm-hmm. What prompted you? Well, you talk about the process.
He himself wrote two books, but I mean, we are talking half a century ago, and they were thin and not very definitive books, and they weren't, in fact, very good. A lot of the other stuff that's been written about Manchester United and therefore Matt Busby, because... I mean, a lot of us grew up thinking of, you think of Manchester United and Matt Busby's face came up in front of your eyes. I mean, he was Manchester United to a lot of us, and his name is still sung by the fans. But the trouble is, a lot of the fans who now sing his name, they're not really very sure why they're singing it. They know that he was a former manager and he was a great, great manager, but I don't think they realise how great, how significant he was.
How did he get the Manchester United job in the first
place?
Well,
he was a player for Manchester before the Second World War. He was a player for Manchester. It may seem ironic now, but his two clubs were Manchester City and Liverpool. And Manchester United's two greatest. And he was with Manchester City for a few years. He came south from Scotland to play for them and
So there is hope for Gary Neville to become Liverpool manager one day.
I think so. There is if the power of prayer works. I pray for it daily. But he then left Manchester City because they signed a really sexy player called Peter Doherty, and he went to Liverpool where he became captain.
Not the baby shambles.
No.
Pete Doherty.
No, very different.
Everybody's head.
I know who that is.
Dearbrand has no idea about baby shambles.
Exactly. They were probably finished before he was born, unless they're still going on. But as the Second World War broke out, he was captain of Liverpool and such a respected captain of Liverpool. In fact, he just welcomed a young player from the northeast called Bob Paisley. Wonder what happened to him. and so he was so respected by Liverpool that he was quietly offered the job of assistant manager. And he said, "Well, I want to be a manager in my own right." Eventually, and they said, "Well, I'm sure George Kay, who was a very successful manager of Liverpool at that time, George won't go on forever," but he didn't want to be standing on George Kay's toes. He loved George Kay. And while he was away at the war, he got the offer to come for an interview at Manchester United. He had a pretty good idea what it was about, what the job he was going to, he wasn't going to be offered a job in the tea bar. And so he came back, and while still in uniform, signed to become, for his first job in management, was as manager of Manchester United. And
he, can you provide just also some context on what Manchester United was back then? Because one of the remarkable things...
It was
things,
the
I
second
think,
biggest team in Manchester.
But what people sometimes don't just read, one of the second biggest team in Manchester, people don't realize about Manchester United is if you go through their history, they've had two periods of extraordinary success, one under Busby and one under some other bloke more recently.
Yes.
And they were hugely popular, but for a long time in their history, they weren't particularly good. And outside of those two periods, they weren't particularly good. In fact, they still hold the record, until Benevento plays again and loses, they still hold the record for a Big Five league for consecutive losses to start a season, 1930-31. Yeah. They lost 12 consecutive games.
At a time when Man City were doing very well. So there was, you know.
So so Busby comes into this club in a big city and whatever, and it's maybe not a rival club to Liverpool back then, not seen the same way, but
what attracted
him? What's his brief?
Yeah, what his brief? He was offered a 3-year contract, and he was told quite correctly that Manchester United were already producing good young players from around the Manchester area, a bit like the class of '92. Apart from Beckham, most of them were from
the Manchester area,
and that was true. Because that team was good enough to win the FA Cup within 3 years of Matt taking over as manager. But he said, no, 3-year contract's not going to be enough. I want to build not just a team, I want to build an entire structure. And that structure, of course, was based on youth. That structure culminated in his best team. He produced three great teams at Manchester United, but the best one was the middle one, the 1948, 1958, 1968. And the 1958 team, the one that was destroyed at in the Munich crash, that was the one he believed was his best. And that was the culmination of his dream, that team.
Full of youngsters as well.
Full of youngsters. Home, I think, at one stage during the building of the Busby Babes, he went 4.5 years without signing so much as a free transfer. 4.5.
He didn't bring in a single player.
He didn't have to, because he had enough coming through the ranks at Old Trafford to build not one team, but two, playing the same way. All these things that now have become, oh yeah, Pochettino is fantastic. Guess what he's thought of? I can't think of many things that are now considered great that Busby didn't do a half a century earlier.
It's also right that it was a different era. Because much easier. In those 4.5 years, when he wasn't signing anybody, he wasn't winning the league and whatever.
He did win the league in one of the seasons.
But he wasn't having
to win the league every year. Like Antonio Conte, he goes 2 months without winning the league and people ask why.
Or indeed even Sir Alex Ferguson years later. He didn't have the Glazers as shareholders.
No. But the interesting thing and the great thing, you mentioned Alex Ferguson, the fascinating thing for me, although I knew it before I wrote it, so I can't pretend to have learned something from my own book, but the amazing thing and the thing that I desperately want people to read and understand is that Alex Ferguson's greatest achievement was to rebuild Manchester United, but not just rebuild Manchester United. He rebuilt Matt Busby's Manchester United with extraordinary faithfulness. The first 5,000 words of this book are about the similarities between the methods and the personalities and the characters, should I say, of Matt Busby and Alex Ferguson. Alex Ferguson rebuilt Manchester United in Matt Busby's image. And you might say, oh, yeah, you're saying it just copied. It's the highest compliment I can pay to Alex Ferguson.
This is a really good point because, so just to talk about myself for a minute, I wasn't living in this country and for most of the 1980s, and Liverpool were the English side that everybody feared.
Yeah.
And United back then were a side that cycled through managers and spent tons of money. This was a team that tried to basically go
in
and spend its
charge, as they call it.
Yeah. And I remember even you know, some of the early Ferguson teams, where obviously he had to produce, and obviously, you know,
very heavily.
You know, but
but you know, Pallister and Neil Webb and you know, and Paul Ince famously, you know, they would just throw money around, and it all felt so fragile, so kind of fly by night, so desperate, like we're going to spend our way out of it.
Yeah.
But all the while,
it was buying time. Yeah,
he was buying time for himself.
That's right.
And he was following the Busby blueprint.
Absolutely. I'm curious. Spot on.
I'm assuming Sir Alex met Busby at some point.
In fact, he said, I mean, a lot has been said about the comfort that Sir Bobby Charlton's presence at Old Trafford was, a real football man at during the early struggling years of Sir Alex Ferguson. But he, in the book, there's a lot of stuff from an old interview that I did with Sir Alex Ferguson in 1993. And he talked, they were on the verge. They were not far off winning their first title under him, which really cemented it. Meant he was fine. He was fireproof. But for a few years, he hadn't been. And he told me, and it was a lovely graphic description. He said, I often used to go into, his main office was at the Cliff, the old training ground. But he said, I often used to go into Old Trafford and I was hoping for something. And as soon as I opened the door of the reception building, if I could smell the pipe smoke, I knew Matt was in. His office was on the first floor, but so strong was his pipe smoke that it would fill the whole reception area. And he said, if I could smell the pipe smoke, I just used to say hello to the receptionist and toddle up there, just have a chat with Matt. And I can't tell you how valuable it was. And it did. But he the great thing that Alex Ferguson did was that he leant on Matt. Yes, definitely, for inspiration. But he embraced his legacy. He didn't sort of say, that's all in the past. Matt Busby, forget it. Yesterday's man. He said, we've got to get back to where Matt Busby was. And in fact, it was Matt Busby that imbued Manchester United with that glamour. When he was at Aberdeen, Alex Ferguson, and he said, he told his chairman, he said, there are only two clubs I'm going to leave Aberdeen for, you know, Dick Donald was the chairman. He said, Manchester United or Barcelona. Now, the only reason he could mention Manchester United in the same breath as Barcelona was because of what Matt Busby had made that club, the glamour.
There's so much more that we could talk about. We haven't even mentioned the three Ballon d'Or winners and 1968 and all this stuff. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but the book is out. I think it makes a tremendous Christmas present the Manchester United fan in your life. And I think we all have Manchester.
Neutrals as well, surely.
Yes, and neutrals.
It's Paddy's writing. I mean, what a brilliant writer he is.
Time now for some quick hits. Heartbreak for Northern Ireland as they're knocked out by Switzerland. And in the end, that highly dubious penalty in the first leg made all the difference. Stuart, this would not have happened if we had VAR in World Cup playoffs. And probably wouldn't have happened if we had additional assistant referees either. But anyway, more importantly, if you were Michael O'Neill, what would you do? Can you go any further?
Not with Northern Ireland, you can't. I mean, he's done brilliantly over the last couple of campaigns. He's got more out of this side than anybody has of recent times. And I think his stock is very high at the moment. It's the right time for him to move on. Say thank you very much. I'm sure a top championship side will come and have a look at him and take him. I'm not sure he'd get into the Premier League at the moment. I think he'd have to do well in the championship and then he might get a job in the Premier League. But
if you were a top championship side who wanted to get promotion, would you hire him with his style of football? Do you think that's appropriate? Do you think that's something that can get you promoted?
Lots of teams have done in the past.
Would you?
Yes, I think he can do it. Whether then when they got into the Premier League, he could change or adapt his style of play, that's another question.
I would have thought it might actually have been the other way around. That if you play that way, maybe you're better suited to staying up near the bottom of the Premier League than you are to...
Well,
getting promoted
I
from
think
the championship.
If he was in the championship, I think he'd. I don't think he's just a coach that would be defensive and try and play long ball football all the time. You have to play a dynamic style in the championship. You have to make sure that you get the ball into the front areas quickly. You have to usually have a couple of front players that combine well. You get promoted by scoring goals.
So stuff that his teams have struggled to do.
but I think he would do it in the championship.
Yeah. I mean, interesting. I'd love to see him in a different context. Croatia have qualified, and James, on paper, they look like one hell of a team, from Ivan Perisic to Luka Modric, from Ivan Rakitic to Mario Mandzukic. Should we be making a bigger deal out of them?
I mean, I think this Croatian generation might have unfinished business at major tournaments. I mean, they've not had a particularly good result this decade, but they've had individually sort of eye-catching results, like beating Spain at the last Euros, and then they lost to Portugal, who ultimately went on to win. I mean, obviously everyone knows they've got a lot. They've got, you know, brilliant crop of midfielders. You've got Modric, Rakitic, Kovacic, but I also think they've got quite an underrated group of strikers. You've got Kramaric, who's been pretty good at Hoffenheim for a season and a half. Kalinic has scored a lot of goals. Mandzukic.
They've got a ton of baggage.
They've got to sack their manager to appoint somebody else who we're not sure is going to take them to the World Cup. Dalic.
The Republic of Ireland drew 0-0 away to Denmark on a horrid pitch in what many neutrals and not so neutrals like Ray Houghton described as a horrid game. Stuart, this is very much in the balance. Thoughts?
Yes, I think they described it exactly right. It wasn't a particularly good game. The Republic of Ireland went to defend and try and be as hard to beat as possible, which you always do when you're going away from home in a playoff game. I think they've got every opportunity to go and win. I've seen Denmark play on 3 or 4 occasions. I don't think they're a particularly good side. I don't think they've got that much creativity. So I think the Republic of Ireland will win the game very narrowly.
Is that good for football?
I'm not sure it's good for football, but it's good for the Republic of Ireland.
Now, one of the main reasons Italy are in the playoffs is that they were second seeds and they ended up in a group of Spain. And that happened because between 2011 and 2015, when the draw was made, they did a horrendous job with friendlies, both in terms of results, winning just 5 of 21, and in terms of scheduling. James, you know a thing or two about this because you've written about an excellent piece, which I think not enough people have paid attention to a while back, certainly not the Italian FA. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I mean, so the principle behind it is that obviously your seeding for World Cup qualification and indeed for the tournament itself is based on your FIFA ranking. And there are certain ways in which you can sort of game the FIFA ranking system to get your ranking as high as possible. The FIFA ranking is based on an average, your average points per match, and qualifiers or games that matter get a much bigger multiplier than friendlies. Friendlies are only worth 40% of what qualifiers are worth. And because it's an average, clearly the more friendlies you play, even if you win them, the more you are inevitably going to dilute your FIFA ranking. And especially if you lose them, of course, because then you get zeros and nothing hurts your average like zeros. There are times to play your friendlies, mostly after the draws and seedings have been made. So, for example, now, obviously, the World Cup seeding is already done, so you can play as many experimental friendlies and lose as many of them as you like. Or...
Well, within reason.
Within reason, sure. Or more than 12 months before the draw and seedings are done, because...
The more recent results count for more.
Exactly.
It's all stuff that Italy just totally ignored, and in fact, they played a friendly, I think it was 1 month, against Portugal, which nobody showed up for, and they duly lost 1-0. Which is a big contributing factor to them slipping out of the top seed. They did it 1 month literally before July 2015, which is when the draw was made. I mean, absolute stupidity.
And if you want the counter example is Poland, who were, I think, top seeds for qualifying. They're top seeds for the World Cup itself, and they, I think, only have played, I think it's 1 or 2 friendlies in the 12 months before the seedings were done.
Well, I'll give you another great counterexample. Romania, who, and I don't think it's a coincidence that our friend Edward happens to be Romanian, because they are top seeds. And do you remember Romania making a splash or reaching the finals of the European Championships in 2012 like Italy did? No. But it's just that they're more intelligent, and more power to them. Plenty of noises coming from Jose Mourinho's camp that he's ready for a new contract. His current deal, of course, expires in June of 2019. And like clockwork, there are stories linking him to Paris Saint-Germain. Stuart, should Woodward bite on this and give him what he wants? Or should he maybe realize that Mourinho really doesn't have that much leverage?
I think he should hold off at the moment. I was very complimentary at the beginning of the season how Manchester United were playing, but in the last few weeks it's gone back to quite dull football. I thought they were very poor against Chelsea. It's a case of wait and see, I would say, for Woodward to see how Mourinho puts this side together over the next few weeks and then make a decision. But it's too early to give him another contract at the moment.
I was kind of going through the process of elimination. I don't think Mourinho has leverage because I don't think there's anywhere that he can realistically go. Not because he's not a good manager, but because he's burned bridges or because they can't afford him or whatever, other than Paris Saint-Germain. And there you've got this massive threat of financial fair play hanging over him. So, yeah, if you're Woodward, you're kind of like, hey, there's nowhere you can go where you can have it as good as here. So let's wait a while.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would do. Wait a while and see what happens over the next few weeks.
Now, we don't often delve into the lower divisions, but I think the Oystons merit mention. James, you've done a lot of reporting on this and a lot of research on this. Can you sum up this lovely duo, what they're accused of doing, and maybe tell us if you can conceive what it must be like to be an Oyston?
I'm not sure about the second part, but the Oystons are the Blackpool owners who have just lost a case at the High Court and been ordered to pay a huge amount of money to the minority shareholder, who's called Valerie Bellicon. And essentially what they're accused of is stripping the club during the period that Blackpool were in the Premier League, taking money out of the club coffers and paying it in to their own companies to the tune of about, I think, £11 million, I think was the figure, described by Mr. Bellicon's barrister as using the club like their own personal cash machine.
I find it extraordinary. I go back to the fit and proper person test that people are really, really taking the absolute mick with this. And the next time you have some club owner crying that, oh, but look, I've put so much money into the club. Believe me, with very, very few exceptions of the Jack Walker variety back in the day, most people who own football clubs do not lose money on their investment. And if they tell you they are, then they're liars.
Gab, one for you. It could be a moot point by the time some people get around to listening to this podcast, but what do Italy need to do Monday night against Sweden to overturn that first leg deficit?
Realistically, they need to win by two clear goals, which is something that they could do on paper because they have a much higher ceiling than Sweden do, but it's something that definitely will not happen if they play a first half like they played in Stockholm last week when they were slow. They were scared. They looked like they had all sorts of psychological hang-ups. They were intimidated. The whole thing is grotesque that they're in this situation. And yeah, you have a whole nation. I think I speak for me. I speak for myself. I speak for others. I just want this to be over. For me, the days between Friday and Monday night are just absolutely horrendous. I can deal with. Obviously, I'd be happy if they made it. And I could actually deal with the disappointment of not being there. But it's this period in between where, as we talk, I tell myself that, hey, look, in about 10 hours' time, everything will be decided. And that is what is completely horrendous to deal with, the uncertainty. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Stuart Robson, James Gearbrandt, and Paddy Barkley. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial for our newspaper. All you need to do is search The Times online. And this season, in addition to our content, you also access highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup. We're going to be back next week after the Premier League returns with that little old thing we call the North London Derby. Till next time, bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.